This is side one of tape two, and we were just talking about an MRG evaluation of Florida and what it looks like.
And so, the word carrying capacity is an old wildlife term. It's how many quail or turkey you can support.
Uh-huh.
And that something that's at the top of the food chain, but how much the bottom can carry on the average. But with carrying capacity of people, it's not only what the area, the land, the waters of Florida will carry, but it's also what you can bring in from outside, that is fuels, in this case, pipelines of gas.
Yes. And what does it mean that we have a 15% carrying capacity?
It means that if the fossil fuels and minerals were completely gone, then you can do all the things with sunlight-based biomass. I mean, you can do fiber and food and housing and all those things, but you can't do them all at the level of the present society. So you have to cut back to 15%.
15% of the current level?
That's right.
Huh.
But now that's not going to happen in a big hurry. It's going to drop a little bit. So that's why if your population goes down at the same rate at which your real wealth use goes down, then you keep things better living.
Maybe this would be a good time to talk about the fossil fuels that we know exist in the eastern Gulf of Mexico that aren't now being drilled. But
back in the days when I was at Texas, I was director of the Institute of Marine Science at Port Aransas. You said Alston, it's a branch of Alston, but it's and so many of our studies of the Texas Bays had to do with the processes that form organic matter that's then covered over by sediments and makes oil. And one of the things we learned there and published about was that any kind of extreme knocks out the consuming organisms and leaves behind the organic matter to form oil. So oils tend to form where there's extremes, and one is extremely briny places, salty, like South Texas. Another is where you get short seasons and you get saltwater ice freezes and the salt remaining is briny and cold, and so wherever in the Arctic you get so you have the Arctic, you have the desert areas of the world and the river deltas, because the river delta you get the surge and then it's salt and then it's fresh and salt, so any of the production of plants is not eaten by the animals. So these are places where oil forms. So oil areas that generate are those that have sediments.
Right.
Not limestone. Coral reefs don't form oils normally because they're porous and it doesn't collect and they don't have any great surges of organic matter, and it's high diversity and it's not, you don't have any extremes. It's so that's why the Bahamas have turned up very little oil, and I think and the potential of Florida the same way, except for the Sunnyland field.
Which is in the Everglades and southwest Florida.
It's very tiny, but it too had a briny condition that was there for a period, that particular geological record. But
so you don't believe there's
I don't think there is any up
petroleum
close to Florida. That's right. There is, as soon as you go west, there is, and obviously Mississippi and then Apalachicola River from there south, and of course that's where they're going to drill next, according to the new plans.
And how about natural gas? Does that follow the same pattern?
Yeah, it's the same thing. The natural gas and oil, and you tend to get the three together in different quantities. But and I think these discussion groups are bringing it out very well, and public's gradually beginning to hear it, even from George W., that there are not in North America, the gas is going to run out. Too many new things are using the gas and they can't find it. And they're, of course, going back to coal, but the coal then you have, it takes more to process it and to keep it clean and all that. And, and the big seams of coal, when they're gone, you get little seams of coal, and they don't give you much what we call net energy. There is, we keep getting poorer and poorer deposits so that we have to put more back in to getting them. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the standard of living, what's left, what you can get beyond what you have to put back, runs everything else. And so if that gets less, the standard of living has to come down.
So do you think we're making a mistake building new coal-fired plants, such as the big one going in Jacksonville?
No. I don't think so. Presuming they will have to take care of the environment better than in the past. But the maximum power principle says you cannot not use energy.
Okay.
If you don't, somebody else will overgrow you and redo it.
Right.
So on that, Nixon and Bush are right on that point.
Yes.
But at the same time, you don't do it wastefully in such a way that you hurt the environment, because that cuts down on maximum power as well.
Right.
So the many of his policies don't keep the environmental production going while you're removing the fuel. And turning loose private industry to maximize their profit is not the way to do it, because then they have no incentive to. So you have to have a tax incentive or something to make sure the environment contributes its real wealth.
What do you think about liquefied natural gas and the potential of moving that into Florida?
Okay, and I just came from Alaska. I was up there a week with my daughter. And of course, that's in all their newspapers too.
Mm-hmm.
Whether to take their North Shore fuels and run it down the present pipeline and liquefy it. Of course, this liquefied. This is refrigerated, and in order to gas, in order to compress it, it takes low temperature, and this gives you essentially a floating bomb. So people don't normally want to move one of those into anywhere around populations.
Right.
So that, for example, I can't think of any place on the West Coast where you would want to have one. And the same with Florida. I doubt if any political would allow it once the dangers were known. I mean, the stuff gets loose. If it doesn't blow up, it may suffocate people, and it's just too dangerous. So that's why there are these plans to perhaps have LNG come in from wherever it is, the Near East or Alaska, wherever.
Or Bahamas, right?
Into a less populated Bahamas, and then run a pipeline down over under the Gulf Stream, which is a mile deep.
Yes.
I mean, it's a huge expenses, and I mean, that kind of thing is going to be discussed. And again, energy is a way to determine which of these alternatives is better.
Right. But you don't think it'll be liquefied natural gas for those reasons you just
stated? No, I didn't say that.
Stated. Oh.
No, I'm saying that whatever is necessary to use the fuel is going to do it. People are going to use it. Now, as to whether, for example, in Alaska, whether they should do that or run the gas back down through the Mackenzie up down through Canada and build that long, expensive pipelines for that. We have to do an energy evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
At the time the Alaska pipeline was being discussed, Mark Brown did the analysis of the whether it was a net energy to do so, and he got a 10-to-1, which means it's a very good. Mm. And so therefore we predicted it would be a success, and it was.
Mm.
We've had very good net energy evaluation. I think has been very successful in predicting. For example, it predicted that the oil shale development was not a net energy, and we testified to Congress, and they ignored the hell out of us. They went ahead with it, and of course both federal government and the oil companies lost about $3 billion, and it didn't work. Because people, there's no way you can tell whether something is useful unless you do an energy evaluation, because
right.
the money doesn't cover all of the aspects.
Could you describe your energy evaluation of Florida Power's nuclear plant at Crystal River?
There was a period when Florida Power, with a very environmentally oriented policy, and had a vice president dedicated to it, and had a whole lot of contracts with us and other universities to understand what they
were proposing and building that nuclear plant and the hot water. And so we did things like measuring the productivity. We measured the oxygen rise and fall in order to do that. And so we measured the productivity of the waters that were getting hot water and found that the trouble was they were not steady hot water, in which case the system could adapt, but they were turning it on and off, had to, because that's the nature of power plants and repairs and things. And so it was knocking out about one half the value.
Just the switch in temperatures.
Yes, huh. In other words, it couldn't adapt very well, so right. on. But then, on the other hand, they're building the cooling tower, and the estimated energy of environmental damage, because you built the tower here, off somewhere, let's say Buffalo, New York, where they're building the steel, or wherever it was, was even greater, so that it turned out that using the environmental cooling, in other words, letting hot water go on into the grass flats and having less productive grass flats by half, was less energy damage to the environment than building the cooling tower to prevent it. Because people building the cooling tower weren't figuring on the environmental load of all that construction somewhere else.
Right.
And that's because the small scales are always... people keep taking too small a scale. And so, well, that result caused all kind of problems, and they had committee meetings, and so they held up that cooling tower for some years, and then the national policy to do it, irregardless, took over, and they and management of the power company changed, and they went ahead and did it and added some more nuclear power and so on. So, but we evaluate a whole lot of things, that intake system, sucking in water from way out and bringing it out and setting up a whole gyro there was a huge change. And but it was interesting the way ecosystems reorganized to fit the new conditions. And that's part of the problem with environment, is that people try to go measure the impact right after some change is made. You shouldn't do that. Wait 3 years and see how nature is built. And it turned out that there was a whole bunch of strange fishes that grow in that kind of a flowing system, and so they were generating a whole new population of fishes, you know.
So
there's a principle there about valuation, short-term evaluation and long-term evaluation.
So are those fishes there now? That new ecosystem is there now?
Well, we haven't evaluated since. I put in proposals to take another look. The present administration of the power is not interested. And they had, of course, they had serious problems with CEOs stealing money or something.
But the upshot was they did not do it.
They did the more expensive thing. And in fact, the national policy has been to and it's a case where the environment movement is strong enough to force something without.
Right.
And so it gives you this struggle between the environment wanting something and profit-making industry wants something, and they compromise, and it's based on political whims of the moment and not on the evaluation that's possible for if you use an M-dollar evaluation.
So you think the environmentalist side on that issue was really not...
In that case, it was not.
Yeah.
It was not. It was a small scale, small myopia. So.
Right. Let me ask, I guess we'll go through some of the big Florida projects that you worked on. I was curious if you had ever worked with Disney or for Disney.
The Center for Wetlands had a project that developed, and I didn't have anything to do with that. It was done later.
Okay.
I brought in Deputy Ronnie Best in turned a lot of projects over to him, particularly when I was going on these sabbaticals. I went off to LBJ school in Texas again to develop our energy concepts in about 80-something. And so that particular project was done, I think Mark Brown might be able to tell you more about it.
So that was after... You didn't work with Disney then?
No, not personally.
Okay, how about your early evaluations of the...
Let me say this about Disney, that when they went to put in a new Epcot things, and they were scanning university for inputs, and we proposed putting in not only the what they wanted, which was a village of the future, with more and more technology, we proposed a village... of the future for living with the lower energy world that's going to be forced on us.
Ah, interesting.
And they turned it down.
Huh. They
just thought it was nutty, I suppose, or they knew their public better. The public's not ready for that.
Right.
The public is going to be ready for it, but they don't know it yet.
When they're forced into it.
Yeah, you cannot use questionnaires to ask people to find out what the public policy will be, because it changes as a whole when they all do it together. They flip together.
Uh-huh.
That's the power of the social system, and which makes it's a, again, an example of the pulsing impact. But the notion that across Florida Barts Canal is spent $500,000 on committee, on the questionnaires, instead of doing an energy evaluation.
And you were involved in that?
No, we were opposed to it, Mark and his associate, Susan Carson, have done an energy evaluation of Cross Florida Barts Canal. They're about ready to publish it.
Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of other things where the public is split, it is not a clear-cut one. It's one where the values of either one are similar. So therefore, the public's struggle... is tracking the real value in that case.
So you were part of the effort to oppose the Cross Florida Barge Canal in the 1970s?
I was at North Carolina
when
and Arlo Lugo was very important here. You know, he's now director of tropical forestry in Puerto Rico, where we interact, but he was here in Botany. And so in the activism to stop, he brought me down to give our evaluation lectures and make our contribution and sign letters. And all that was successful, and Nixon stopped it.
Yes.
So that was our primary involvement then.
So now, what was the purpose of doing an energy evaluation of it now?
It's whether to remove the
Rodman Reservoir.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So not whether the government should have done the whole...
No, it was...
Okay.
It wouldn't be hard to show that it, after all, it started as a way to avoid submarines in the Second World War, and it kind of lost sight of the purpose of it all. So.
Yes. Back to Disney, it would be interesting to do an energy analysis of Disney itself.
Yes.
Have any of your grad students done that one,
and you're right, that would be it wouldn't be hard to do, I think, if they give you the facts.
That's
what do you need for one of those? Well, for one thing, you have to have all the costs involved, and the flows of money, because that's that identifies things that were purchased and brought in, and then you have to have the actual fuels and all those things, and environmental measures as well.
Mm-hmm.
And number of tourists and the amount of money they brought in.
Right.
We've done it for the whole state, and we've done it for about 10 counties.
Uh-huh. Well, if you've done it for the Civil War, you can do it for Disney.
That's right, that's right.
Could you talk about the early evaluations of the Cape Coral, Marco Island, Naples, that southwest Florida area?
At the same time we got our Center for Wetlands money, we also got the attention of Nat Reed and his aide, George Gardner.
So this is about 1973?
Yeah, a little later. And they picked up on all this and set up a set of projects and got state planning involved.
Was that when Nat Reed was working for Nixon, or?
No, He was undersecretary. Who would that be under?
Nixon.
Okay, I'm not sure of that.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah. So we had a whole set of projects involved. We call the South Florida projects, and we put out. This was probably $500,000, which is nearly 10 times that now. So we evaluated a whole lot of things in mm-hmm. South Florida, and then did we picked several counties to emphasize, and Hendry and Collier. Mm-hmm. In Lee County, and we also did the Keys and Monroe County and the Everglades Park and the Everglades itself and Okeechobee and the Kissimmee and all these things. And our reports were regarded radical at the time, and the present revisions now going on in the Everglades are doing the things we recommended.
Really?
And our energy evaluations weren't published, but they weren't yet called energy. And we had problems because we didn't know how much solar energy was equivalent to fuel energy. Mm-hmm. And it took us until 1980s to get that clear, to get the numbers right. And so we have these unpublished reports, so a lot of evaluations. And Nordley, for example, Frank Nordley over here in zoology, he helped us edit one set of these, and I dug those out last year and set them up for possible publication with the corrected values that we know how to convert solar energy into higher level energy, which is the thing that's hanging up the solar energy in the world. People think you can jump, and they don't know how dilute solar energy is. And so the solar center here, we've been off and on arguing with them and at times collaborating with them. Mm-hmm. And the present guys over there, they understand pretty well, and they've been, and they even put energy evaluation in one of their handbooks. But earlier on, we had our problems with mechanical engineering about this, about whether you can, whether solar energy is too dilute to replace fossil fuels. And that, of course, is the thing that the country still hung up on.
Mm-hmm. And what's the answer?
You can't, because the most efficient conversion possible is, after a billion years of evolution, is through biomass. And so if you work on your technology, you're going to eventually get that same efficiency, but that's the limit.
Uh-huh.
So it takes many joules of sunlight to make one joule of fuel, and you can't. That's not something you're going to be able to short. They're trying to short jump it. They're trying to take the solar energy and jump right directly to electricity.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it, but you put so much back into mm-hmm. it to do it, you don't get any net.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what that's in our books. This one, and the details are in this one, and people are torn on this, and the solar lobby doesn't want to believe us.
Yes, yes. Now, what was controversial about these South Florida reports that you did?
Well, for example, that the Kissimmee Channel, Tim Gale did his thesis a beautiful job of showing how they channelizing the Kissimmee River, the mm-hmm. water that used to take 3 months and arrive after hurricane season would come zipping down and arrive in the hurricane season and then have to dump it in the ocean.
Yes.
So all that water was wasted, not only that, but all the productivity of the wetlands and all the filtering.
So
was,
all the things we know now,
that's right.
You guys were saying in 1973.
Yeah, that's where it came from. And mm-hmm. so they were, that was, now that policy is straightened out. But, but they're still, they put it back, but they could have put it back easily by just putting a set of dynamite charges down there, blowing it up and let the water reorganize it. But instead, they're doing it by, you know, bulldozers and step by step. And I guess, people don't have confidence in the fact that nature's self-organization is what you're going to have to fit anyway. So why spend all this special energy trying to copy it?
What were some of the things you found out about Cape Coral and Marco Island in Naples?
Well, of course, Cape Coral didn't have the or you had displaced all this value and then you drained the, by cutting the deep channels,
right.
you'd undermine the groundwater.
So that had already been done by the time you looked at it.
Yeah, but we showed what's wrong with it, and also the lack of fresh water. But discovered, Maricel's studies discovered that the wastewaters at Naples were, that they were turning loose from the treated sewage and going up in the mangroves, and the mangroves were profiting by it, and they weren't hurt by it, and they had faster growth. And another demonstration that wetlands, marine wetlands in this case, are a good way to ameliorate this big problem that Florida has and still has, is these excess nutrients.
Right. So in Naples, this wastewater actually helped the mangroves.
Yes.
And I don't quite understand about Cape Coral, though. Why? What is it different there? Because these are man-made and
well, let's
fresh
see.
Water?
They cut off an area there, and so that they, as Flora Wangle and our group showed, if you cut a channel with Florida's porous sands, which have 20-30% pore space, and or limestones, or even that, then the water table is dropped for a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a deep channel, you've dropped the water table. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the plants can't reach it. So you turn it into a desert. The water, the rain that falls on it doesn't hold, doesn't sit there. It just shoots down to the bottom and out. So, I mean, that's not proper way to. There's a notion that you drain and you turn the climate of South Florida into an Australian hydroperiod, and so things like Melaleuca then come in, and that's one of the big issues, by the way, that I didn't put in my list, is exotics. And exotics are one of the best tools that nature uses to get productivity out of areas that have changed. And, and so if you, unless you can change the regime back to the way it was, you need to learn to live with exotic, because it's doing something that it's giving you a productive, but the first time you put in an exotic moves in, it's a monoculture, and it's not. And so you, how do you maintain a higher diversity, and how do you eliminate the excesses that cause exotics to be monocultures instead of just adding to the diversity? These are all questions.
Does this mean you think we're making a mistake spending so many millions to take the Melaleuca back out of South Florida now?
The way it's done, probably, yes. You haven't really changed the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
If it's too bad we didn't build Florida up, and let the water regime stay the same. But it's too late for that right now. You've already got the housing at the ground level,
right.
And now the water table has to be below that, and so that turns it into a desert climate, and so that favors those kinds of plants, and also its strategy is to transpire and use up the water and keep itself dry. It adapts to wetland conditions by wasting the water, whereas the original cypress reflects the energy and saves the water and keeps it wet, and so that's why if you want a headwaters, then you have to keep the pond cypress, not ball cypress, but pond cypress regime if you want to continue to have headwater.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why all of the headwaters, starting with the Okefenokee in southern Georgia, and the green swamps, and the big cypress, and the Withlacoochee headwaters, and everywhere all over the state, preserving the headwater swamps is maintains water, because that particular vegetation doesn't transpire, it doesn't grow,
right?
It saves instead.
So the exotic species aren't as bad as the current scientific community would make us think that they are.
Well, I wouldn't call. Depends on what.
There seems to be a real eradication effort statewide.
That's misguided.
Particularly
in aquatic plants. In other words, the proper solution is to cut off the nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
That's to cut them off at the source. And people are beginning to catch on to this, and more and more recommendations, and the Everglades, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
and or just put in strips of wetlands to catch it,
mm-hmm.
And go ahead and accept that you have to have a eutrophic monoculture wherever there's an excess, and that you're going to have that, otherwise, and then the water coming out of that will now be oligotrophic and usable in a more normal way, but unless you can stop the nutrients at the source, you're going to have to let there be a wetland, eutrophic type wetland to catch those. But instead, we've got the aquatic plant policy of absurd going out poisoning or cutting or removing them, and of course they will just grow right back because you haven't changed the mm-hmm. condition. You have, nature's trying to tell you something. Nature's way of getting rid of any excess is to bind it up in the peat, and that's done in solar energy. It doesn't cost you anything, and that's what you should do. But it does take land area. And that's the problem in the Everglades and everywhere else, is you don't have much land area left
right.
with which to catch nutrients. But you sure can go back and stop put regulation or something on all these companies that spread fertilizer and poisons on the grass and get people to xeriscape and all those things. It's in the news, and
yes.
even yesterday's paper, people are coming around to it.
But what would have been the better way to handle the aquatic plant invasions?
I just said, which is to cut off the nutrient source to mm-hmm. the waters by putting a strip of wetlands
mm-hmm.
and by stopping it at its source.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the septic tanks, let's say, that are going into some lake and turning it into eutrophic.
Right.
If you don't mind the eutrophic lake, it'll be a good.
Uh-huh.
It's like a sewage pond in Texas. I mean,
right.
It's all right. But if you would like a lake that's clear water for other purposes and doesn't have great oxygen swings, then you have to keep the nutrients from getting that far.
Mm-hmm.
The aquatic plant people, I don't know where they're coming from. They're just wasting money.
Mm-hmm. They're wasting money by trying to poison the plants.
Or to remove them.
Or remove them.
Yeah, because instead of getting at the fundamental, which is to change the nutrients of the water flow.
And some of these people you're talking about are people on the IFAS faculty.
I'm not pointing at anybody. I'm talking about the policy of the state
mm-hmm.
in supporting these big projects and aquatic plant projects.
But it does.
You want me to identify people, and I haven't kept up with who's continuing the poor policies.
Yeah.
I'd rather say that people are catching on. There,
right.
It's about to switch, and you won't.
Right.
And but we still have people in. For example, whereas ecological engineering
mm-hmm.
gives you the proper concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Puts out a handful of people. You still have biology departments everywhere putting out 10 to 100 times that many people.
Right.
And what are they taught? Well,
right.
conservation. Well, conservation, there's a society of restoration, and it does some of the same things Ecological Engineering Society does.
Right.
Except the whole word is wrong. Restoration implies you're supposed to go back to something.
Yes.
Whereas if the conditions are going to be the same as they were, you can go back to it, but if the conditions are going to be with humans and environment and higher nutrient levels, then you have to have a new system, and
mm-hmm.
that means new species and new designs, and
mm-hmm.
And the trick is how to get it all to maximize the landscape productivity. So we just have so many people that go into these jobs, and it takes them 5 to 10 years to catch on.
Yes, but when is it beneficial to reintroduce or to, for example, we talked about the ivory bills and the Carolina parakeets, and you know, is it ever possible or is it ever a good idea to try and reintroduce species?
Sure,
mm-hmm.
if they're there, and if you've got a habitat that will support them.
Mm-hmm.
Carolina parakeet, apparently, according to the early ornithology books, got a lot of its nutrition out of the cypress balls.
And,
but the great with all the great cypress forests and all the big forests except a handful of, like the Corkscrew Swamp and one or two along the Tamiami Trail, were all destroyed, and we hardly even have a demonstration for the public to see. So I don't think there's enough habitat for the ivory bill right now. Maybe the carol. There's so many parrots and parakeets loose in South Florida now, I keep thinking that eventually one will catch on that can live under the new circumstances and spread. In other words, I'm in favor of exotics that are adaptive.
So you're speaking of the feral parakeets?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know whether there may be somebody that knows this, but whether some of these new ones or whether any of them are using any of the natural sources of food, or whether they're all attached to people and their fruit trees and things.
Ah, I see. I wanted to just go back and finish talking about Southwest Florida. How about the work you did on Marco Island?
I'm trying to name the ladies who did a lovely thesis on it, and I have to dig that up.
Okay,
for you.
We'll fill that in.
And at that time, the developers had a trick. They'd cut off the water to the mangroves, and they died. And they said, see, died, and nothing we can do about it. Now we have to develop it. So they did that on Marco Island. And then, so they put up a few high-rises, and then people would come down, and they'd say, ooh, look at all this space, and look at my kids can play out there in the swamps and this and that. And of course, but they'd buy up, and then by the time they got there, instead of one, there'd be 10. And so all of a sudden, in order to have all those cars, you ended up paving the place over. So that that particular pattern, so we did an image evaluation of that. It may have still been called embodied energy. That was one of the theses. Same time, there was still rancor about Agent Orange, you know, was used. And in this, 70s, I was on the committee of the National Academy to evaluate that problem, and the war was still going on, so that would make it 72, I think. And so we all went to Vietnam and did experiments and sprayed Agent Orange and studied its effects and how long it lasted, and it was a $2 million project involving many universities and people. Our part was the mangrove part at Mung Tau, and it's pretty interesting field work. You'd be out there and then protected by two people standing by with machine guns
in case
you were. But we, of course, learned later that the place we were studying was there was an unwritten agreement that they wouldn't fight in that area. They said, we want to use it for recreation for both sides.
Wow.
So anyway, there was a lot going on in there.
What did you learn about the
But what we learned, of course, was the stuff didn't have any long-term staying powder. It didn't last. I mean, to kill the mangroves outright, trees inland would come back because they had storage. The mangroves, since they were evergreen, didn't store the energy, so if you kill them, they wouldn't come back. And so we recommended that they replant them with, use bombers to bring seedlings from Thailand and reseed the place, and the Vietnam committee members that were on our national committee says, no, we want to turn it into rice paddies. And so we didn't recommend that, but we did evaluate it, and Mark evaluated the whole war, so we did show the 10-to-1, the energy of running the war, 10 times of it was coming from the U.S., and that same energy was being used by the other side to fight back. It was an incredible evaluation of war, the first really good one, and of course we've since evaluated the Civil War and others.
Right.
But, and so, what happened then was all the refugees went into these places that had been partly cut, and they cut down all the dead trees to make charcoal, and then they started on the live trees. So what had been a partially damaged mangrove area was stripped bare. There are 40 species of mangroves in Southeast Asia, and in Europe, in this country there's only four. And so the outcome of it was not only the American spraying, but also the refugee stripping.
Yes.
So I went to the National Congress of Japan several years ago and heard a paper by Vietnamese on what they had done with that land, North Vietnamese, after they took over.
What'd you find?
And, you know, they didn't turn it into rice paddies. They did plantations of mangroves, one species. So instead of 40 species natural, they set up forestry plantations of one species.
What did they use them for?
For wood, charcoal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was the federal government, back to the Southwest Florida studies.
Okay,
it was
the reason I got on that was that
the mangroves.
We did one of the tests. Howard Tees took Agent Orange and sprayed a plot down at Marco Island with Agent Orange, with one of the two. One of them was illegal. One at that time, he got away with one of them. One of the two. So here's this area that's been killed, and so we studied it. He lost interest, and so we did a study of. So that was one of the many things that were done there. Maurice Hill did that one.
Mm-hmm.
The rate of recovery and afterwards. So we got a real detailed view of how quick, if the seeding is there, how quick it
uh-huh.
could be restored.
But you said initially it was a developer who sprayed Agent Orange on mangroves down there illegally?
No, it wasn't.
Oh.
It was just
a scientific experiment.
It was a scientific experiment. Pseudo legal.
We
didn't do the spraying, but we did the measurements.
Mm.
It's part of our South Florida.
And these South Florida project, was it funded by the federal government?
Yes,
then?
Yes, Department of Interior.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. But it was half. No, it was two thirds. I think 2/3 federal, 1/3 was from the Division of State Planning, and that probably was Earl Starr.
Yes.
I'm not trying to remember. Yeah.
Yes.
So, he would know that.
Right, and I'm still trying to get at what was controversial about your reports. The public just wasn't ready to hear these things? The developers were angry? What was...
No, I don't think the full impact ever reached.
I see.
It's spotty. We published things, and it was going too fast. We were doing too much, and,
uh-huh.
and we should have spent more time. And as part of the project, we put out four public affairs booklets, and
uh-huh.
they talked about growth and non-growth and energy and
mm-hmm.
net energy and all those things, and then in the context of those counties, and we had splinter projects. Naples, Florida has a river down the middle called a small river called Gordon River, and they wanted to dredge it,
mm-hmm.
and it was a controversy, and so the county put out RFP asking people to bid on it. So we bid on it with my hydrologist collaborator, Wayne Huber. We didn't know it. We were bidding against Art Marshall, who had set up an institute in Miami or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave it to us instead of Marshall. That was too bad, because we had certainly proved what he was trying to do.
Right.
So then we did a real first-class job on it, and so that's how we did the whole, worked in the water of Naples was based, because the deeper ground has salt in it, because it was in that part that was flooded in the Pleistocene. So
mm-hmm.
below 25 feet in the whole state of Florida, the groundwaters are not suitable. They're too salty.
Right.
And so they were using the superficial sands, and that so they take the rain one year was used up by the end of the year, and so they were really limited. So we worked out all that, and of course the solution was not to dredge that. If you dredge that river channel, you would have sucked the water right out of their water supply.
Right.
It wasn't hard to prove that. And,
right.
And so that got us down there, and we saw instances where developments and where they had built the roads up through wetlands and thus preserved the wetlands
mm-hmm.
rather than draining them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a whole lot of guidelines. And we put out for the state, we put out an aquatic wetlands guidelines is the title, but it's it's been reprinted a couple
so
times.
So you were listened to in that
case? Yeah, well, sure, yes. Sure. I didn't mean to imply we weren't listened to, but the energy crisis came and went, and people were, and I think we probably, the minute we start talking about eventual leveling and coming down, then we lose people, because then they throw everything else out. And
right.
Maybe it'd been better. I remember one time my brother tried this in the lecture he gave in New York, somewhere along in there, and he called me up and he says, "It didn't go over. I'm not going to use that anymore." You know, it was, to me, what's that got to do with anything? you know, are we in the business of being public relations?
Right.
Or are we trying to find the truth and maybe shock people into taking notice of it? And, of course, the truth somewhere in between, I'm sure.
Right. So you aren't in the business of making people happy or telling them what they wanted to hear.
We could have done better, I'm sure, but we were pulled in too many different directions, and then and published stuff, published enormous quantities, but who knows?
Yeah, I would like to go back and get the name of the woman who did the Marco master's thesis when we have a chance.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn the tape over now. This is side 2 of tape number 2. Starting side 2 of tape 2, I was just going to ask Dr. Odom about the keys part of the South Florida study. Go ahead.
Well, the man who's now professor of environmental medicine at University of Colorado came down from Emory and did the keys. Did our embodied energy evaluations there, and was published this dissertation. I don't think we adequately ever published all these things because we were still struggling to get the solar fuel relationship quantitatively. So. I guess there's about 20 theses and dissertations that that have a lot of these things, and it's possible that we should go through and pull out a few important conclusions that certainly they went into the intellectual community and did spread.
Yes.
But the coral reef off the Keys is deteriorating, and all this dredging up and down making it turbid. Of course, corals require light, and they're shaded out, and then they've been hit with all kinds of overfishing. And our student McClanahan had demonstrated that if you overfish the larger fishes, like the triggerfishes on the reefs, then the balance. They are really managers, and the balance of different things falls apart, and the urchins run wild, and the reef collapses, so to speak, becomes a weedy bunch of struggling organisms, the way many people think ecosystems are, and instead of a very highly organized and coordinated ecosystem, which is our view of it. And so that's... I saw the reef again a couple of years ago, and it was hardly looked like a coral reef. It's covered with patches of dead stuff and algae and so on. So surely Florida's environment's deteriorating badly because of it's a combination of eutrophication, the adding the organic matter, which grows back microbial populations instead of the clear water, which causes the self-contained reefs with its entire tightly cycled zooxanthellae and the corals and their food chains, all in clear water, taking advantage of of the currents and wave action. But So, I mean, the so-called red tides and so on are spreading. Mm-hmm. You know, now we talk about brown tides, and there are new microbes are becoming dominant, and a lot of it is tied to the just increasing levels of civilization dumping organics into the water.
Yes, it, but you also mentioned it's overfishing as well.
In the coral reefs.
Uh-huh.
If you take a... We were fortunate enough to study... So essentially, virgin coral reef in Inuitok in the 50s, when it's the one where my brother and I worked together and
yes.
got a prize on it. And the it had been left 20 years at least without any people, and just such a the very best of the kinds of pictures you'll see on television or from places like that, with, you know, large schools and highly diverse and beautiful patterns of corals and their algae and so on. We took one of those windjammer cruises once and went to the different ones in the Bahamas, you know, and
uh-huh.
they'd stop and you'd go look and you'd hardly see a parrotfish. And,
oh.
and those you see are deathly scared and run away. And,
yes.
Most people, when they go Cancun or somewhere, they see don't see really good coral reefs. They see remnants.
Yeah, and what will be the impact of that? The loss of the coral reefs, that is.
What you've done is substituted. Again, you say, "Well, how come maximum power?"
Mm-hmm.
A system with a lot of fuel that knocks out the environmental system still has more power than the environmental system had by itself. So the long run effect is as your fossil fuels are cut back, then all kinds of efficiencies and economies will come in, and the environment will, if you manage to hang on to some remnants, it'll come back, and we'll get it back. That's why it's so important to protect what you have in the way of seed ecosystems,
yes.
so they can come back. And so there's a lot of optimism for the environment. It's not so good for human economy unless we learn how to reduce our population and also the waste of using cars instead of reorganizing around less fuel costing transportation.
All right. I'd like to come back to that at the very end when we, you know, maybe have you talk a little bit about the future. I wanted to ask you, did you do very much consulting work on behalf of developers, the development industry?
Well, I made a policy never to consult, except to give lectures.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take an honorarium for giving a lecture, but I never consulted.
It
didn't seem like it. If I'm paid by the state to try to find the right answer in all these controversial issues, I shouldn't be taking money from either side,
except
from the public, except from the university.
So when you did the FPNL study, that was
that's
on behalf of...
No, that's a contract to the university.
Oh, okay.
All our projects were, you know how research works in university, and you have a grant and a contract, and it's all, most of the money goes for students.
Mm-hmm.
If you're on a 12-month salary, then... if you're on 9 months, sometimes they would pay some summer salary at your regular rate, but there was no honoraria or no salary increase or anything like that that kind of came from
So you didn't work very closely with developers during these times. I know you said you've had students who you watched go out into the world with their great ideas and what they've learned to work for either government or private industry, and that's sometimes been a disappointing experience. Could you talk about that well, experience?
Well, the case that's often quoted is, well, Scott Nixon, who was graduated from North Carolina and went to Rhode Island, and they said, if you want to get tenure here, you quit doing that energy stuff and start doing your phytoplankton ecology. Mm-hmm. Or they forced him to go back to scale, and of course mm-hmm. he did, and he's head of Sea Grant and had been a very successful career there, but he left the... He's been all like the rest of his field, forced to be one scale too small to answer these larger questions.
Yes, yes.
Same thing happened to Mike Kemp, and he had done the Apalachicola River and in Franklin County energy study, and all the questions of dredging that river and the saltwater passes and the oyster industry and the way it was courting troubles with disease because of the salinity changes and mm-hmm. all that. So he gets up to Maryland and they tell him, "So, well, your major professor may be able to do that kind of stuff, but you can't. And you quit this nonsense about evaluating the economy and the environment and start studying the animals, you know." So that's a... that's the people who are, have the framework of orientation of their own training, and and these folks either had they're all small scale trained. That is either chemists or geology, or geology is pretty large scale, but it has not normally included humans, and biology trained, and of course biology is. Was bad enough when I came along as far as its scale of interest, and I was lucky to have a major professor that, who was not so confined because mm-hmm. he hadn't been trained just in biology, but but then the world went to molecular biology, which is an important field, and but then and even while I was in North Carolina, that was happening. So in order to be a good molecular biologist and take all the courses that go with that, and it squeezed out, automatically squeezed out, hydrology and economics and geology and all the things that you need to do to understanding about environment. So it's been even worse. People coming out sometimes that environmentally illiterate coming out of the biology departments and being hired by environmental agencies.
And all those things you mentioned, the human and the microscopic, it all seems to be coming together in the Chesapeake Bay and in North Carolina with this issue of fisteria.
That's one example. And we just we made a, while we were at Beloit this summer, we have a program called Extend that allows you to make very attractive little icons on the screen. You connect them up and then they simulate. And so we made up one for fisteria. Of course, my former associate, B.J. Copeland, who was one of our best people at, when I was director at the University of Texas Marine Institute, he became head of Sea Grant there at North Carolina State in later years. And of course, he was the fisteria turned up, and some lady used pressure on the legislature to have to get $500,000 or something for
Joanne Burkholder.
You know about it, right? Mm-hmm. There was a book written on this recently.
But,
and so I guess his job was to try to get the research done. So he wanted to spread the money among more than one investigator to get certain things done. And so she went. She put pressure on and got him fired. And so So anyway, that's a nasty story in North Carolina. I don't know all the details, but so there was a published a book which took her side of it, just published, and there was an article recently putting that book down, so I don't know the latest.
Well, it seemed to be a very hysterical sort of a book, and it was unscientific, and I remember reading a review of it where the writer, for example, described her you know, fiery blue eyes and described her physically, you know, so you can kind of see that it was very dramatic. But I did want to ask you about the media, so maybe this is a good time to ask you about that.
Mark Brad.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll ask you when we come back.
All right, okay.
Lunch break. This is the Howard Odum interview, and we were just talking about the rather sensational book that has been published about Feasteria. And that was leading into a question about how the media covers environmental issues, and particularly in Florida. How do you think the media does covering environmental issues, and how has that hurt or helped public understanding?
Well, of course, there are individuals who are well-trained in the environment in the media, but in general, most have had economics, but not environment.
Huh.
And have... no judgment about what's an issue, and create and antithesis, adversarial. When they should be discussing all the factors, they instead try to get opposite sides to argue and create something. So I think that it's, media coverage is not good in most cases. Public has the same problem in that they when they go to high school or even college, they don't get they may get some economics, and that's all. They don't get economics and environment in their proper perspective.
Yes, and it sounds like you're also saying the issues are perhaps made too black and white.
Well, they don't even usually get the right issues. They create false issues.
And,
example, I'm not sure it's related to Florida particularly, but you know, Biosphere 2 is an example where we had three of our students participate in this. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, but why don't you explain Biosphere 2?
Okay, Biosphere 2 is a multi-million dollar project that was set up in the mountains 4,000 feet near Tucson, Arizona, funded by one of the name slips for the minute of the billionaires, and very remarkable set of people who developed the project and had splendid engineering, and several had science backgrounds, and they built this thing, and people moved in for 2 years, you know, and and they had overdid the public relations and called everybody's attention, and in some extent, imagination. But then scientists who are small scale didn't understand its significance, and also, I suppose, were jealous of the money going. And and what, because some of the people there who were not fully trained in, with science degrees, they just blasted them, and then the newspaper people took that point of view and just massacred them and created the entirely wrong point of view. Two of the people who were inside afterwards came here and did PhD degrees, Linda Lay and Mark Nelson. I worked with a Harvard faculty member in editing this volume, which pulled the best of both the people that were in there, plus the team that followed when the billionaire got tired of and got improperly... turned against the original team because everybody was saying it was terrible and it wasn't. And so they walked in one day and threw everybody out and threw some people in jail, and it was terrible business. And then Columbia University ended up taking over, and they changed the concept to a growth chamber instead of it being a self-organized chamber.
Yes.
So this, you know, it's $350 million, and what it needs to become is a national lab. But it's beautiful work, and we, by putting this book out, we documented it, and but it doesn't change the public image.
Right.
So, the media are not capable of handling environmental things because they take some specialist and their prejudices and spread them out and try to create controversy with it and leave people with the wrong impression. And it's really sour business.
What's the answer to that? What's the solution there? How do you
communicate
ideas?
First, require a journalist to have
course in environmental science and economic balance. Well, where are those courses? Well, we're the only ones that give them to a handful of students. And
right.
So, and we've written the books to do it, but they're not being adopted because people who are going to adopt them don't know their own ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Right. What are some of the important lessons that came out of Biosphere 2 that you have put together in this book that the public should have known about but never found out about?
Well, it's a model for the whole world. In other words, it had more respiration, that is, more carbon dioxide generation than it had plant use at first.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you had accumulation of carbon dioxide with all its properties and the things getting acid and the oxygen being embedded is used up in the process. And here, it happens quickly because it's a small thing, only 3 acres in size, whereas the whole globe takes thousands of years to fully show it. And so very quickly, they ran out of oxygen, had to move an oxygen tank up. It's the most beautiful demonstration of how beautiful this Earth is, self-organized by its many ecosystems and the way they interplay in the ocean and the atmosphere. The coupling that has developed is self-organization over some billions of years. How much it took to try to even simulate enough of an Earth for the 8 people that were inside.
Right, right. I guess we'll go back to some of Florida's big environmental issues that we hadn't finished talking about. One was Lake Okeechobee. Did you do very much work there?
Yes, well, that was part of our Kissimmee-Okeechobee Everglades. And,
right.
So we had the evaluation of it, and we simulated the and showed the how the phosphorus was increasing and its turnover time and what would be necessary to keep it where it was. And so those are, it was all shown in the thesis by Tim Gale way back in the 70s. And of course, the present plan is to try to, to back up. When the hurricanes drowned those people back before the Corps of Engineers put up its levees, it wasn't. It was because the farmers had put up a flimsy dike, so they had held the water back. If that dike hadn't been there, I think the water was simply overflowed, and instead it built up and then crashed and caused. So then that next thing they put up this giant levee, and then they, in order to keep water from overflowing it or getting too high, they dump it in the sea. So that's being corrected now.
Right.
But they've still got the wrong plan. We just did a new evaluation, and I distributed it around to all the boards that are involved with this. They're still trying to hang on to the agriculture just south of the...
Right.
And there's one strip there that's already got bounded by their existing ditch levees, that the first... sector there that could be turned into a eutrophic slough that is let all the things like hyacinths and any aquatic plants let it grab the nutrients and sediment them into the as you have to do, that's nature's way, and then the water coming out of that sector would then be oligotrophic, would then be what they're trying to get. Instead, they're trying to do it with a piecemeal, setting up some little tiny wetlands and pumping them here and there and pumping into the ground and under and all sorts of artificial ways when this,
right,
the original way they could easily restore. That area is too deep now. It would be too deep for rooted plants, and the agriculture has already failed there because they had to get refunded from the federal government the sugar last year. And,
yes.
And global sugar is, it's completely against all economic principles for us to subsidize sugar here, just because we don't like Cuba and so on. And those are Cuban exiles that are running the sugar anyway. And
yes.
So it's quite clear what needs to be done. And so we interact some with the committees involved, such as the committee that John, the nephew of Art Marshall, John Marshall. And so we're spreading this information around. We'll see if they maybe come around to it eventually. It's been my experience. We get our ideas and spread them broadly give it some time, and they usually get around to it. Maybe they try the wrong thing first and then come back to it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the impact of the water management districts on the state, particularly the South Florida Water Management District? How good of a job do you think they've done?
Well, on the one hand, we have districts that are supposed to manage water and have some taxing authority and can try to do something, which many states don't have.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, that one, the first one, which was set up, was, you know, mainly aimed at grabbing more water for agriculture originally, and then for Miami. And of course, that's the disaster we're trying to undo.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, the present plan is being implemented because it gives more water to the Gold Coast development.
Mm-hmm.
Still, there's progress there.
Mm-hmm. Right. The restoration plan is really an urban water supply plan, not
partly.
So much of an environmental restoration plan.
Well, partly. They're trying to restore the oligotrophic glades, but... And, of course, the cutting off of that water did many other things.
It mm-hmm.
not only gave the Everglades Park this too much, too little pattern, mm-hmm. but the salt water moved in all through the lower Everglades and produced dwarf mangroves everywhere. Dwarf mangroves are when the salt's too high, so when the water goes to transpire, it pulls against the gradient too hard. And so if it's too... Mangroves normally will have double the salinity in their roots as
mm-hmm.
they pump the water out, leaving salt behind, but then the salt works its way out through crab holes.
Mm.
But if it gets too salty, then even the sun's transpiration can't pull against that gradient, so they end up with a little tiny dwarf. And so that's what is around the Florida Power & Light Corporation one there. We were talking about Florida Power at Crystal River there, Florida Power & Light at Miami, you know, was the big controversy about whether to put that hot water out into those grass flats.
That's near Biscayne National Park.
Right. And so the public opinion forced them not to put it out.
Right.
And so they built this grid of water that goes up and down and up and down and
mm-hmm.
up and down. And unfortunately, they paved a lot of it, which
mm-hmm.
was a mistake, instead of letting the nature come in. I don't know whether they've corrected that or not.
Hmm.
But that was another example of a huge expense. It was, according to our Crystal River work, was incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
In order
mm-hmm.
they could have made some compromise with and been better. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
nature tries to organize, and there's supposed to be some crocodiles growing in there.
I've seen them. Yeah,
okay.
It's full of crocodiles.
Well, you've seen it since I have. What's how much mangroves are in the grid?
You know, I didn't see any mangroves
in
the grid.
They lost the opportunity.
It was just there's no growth on it.
Yeah,
but there. Yeah, there was quite a bit of wildlife, birds and crocs, but that was it.
Yeah. Well, nature will self-organize as best as it can to fit humans. That's part of the ecological engineering.
Uh-huh.
But
what's the impact of dwarf mangroves?
Well, you've knocked the productivity of what was productive and a full community ecosystem with all sorts of things happening, diversity and things. You've just knocked it down to probably 10 or 20% function. It's like a desert, in other words.
Hmm. One more thing about the Everglades. What do you think of the ASR, aquifer storage recovery technology that they plan to use to store water deep underground to pull up later when they need it?
Well, that's the one I was objecting to. They're doing that in place of giving up this small amount of agriculture. See, this wouldn't give up all the agriculture. In fact,
if
you could offer to the agriculture the opportunity to pump their waste into this eutrophic slough, because that's what it is, a slough that is a nutrient-absorbing slough.
Mm-hmm.
And about 20 years ago, we published our plan for a strip to come all the way down that everybody could pump into or pump out of as a way of getting the nutrients out of the agriculture and into this one slough. Again, the same thing. So now this is another version of our earlier plan.
Okay, and again, that area would give you enough storage room for the amount of fresh water they need?
It would give you enough nutrient absorption capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question you're asking me now is a different one. You're asking whether or not they need the water storing capacity.
Well, part of the reason they claim they need it is for the urban population.
We did a Martin County report.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've done a number of county reports and used our image analysis. And And our point, they were they have an excess of water. They're the one where the Stuart Canal comes through. And,
oh, right.
And what? And our point was that the limitation to economic growth. What? Not talking about fossil fuels now. If when those are steady, the limitation is water, as we most everybody mm-hmm. comes to realize, and that Martin County ought to quit letting that water get thrown away and mm-hmm. set up its own storages for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm for any procedure to store mm-hmm. fresh water
mm-hmm.
for, in other words, you can get more total energy production,
mm-hmm.
more total value out of fresh water on land, which mm-hmm. is what the earth tries to do. The earth tries to put the rain on land.
Yes.
And keeping it there and getting the good out of it gives you more than letting it run into the sea.
Yes.
Now, when it runs in the sea, it's not always that, because it drives currents and makes the estuaries more fertile and does a lot of secondary things. So if you take fresh water that's been going into an estuary and take it away, then the estuary loses about half of its productivity.
Yes.
and its faunas and floras and all those fisheries
mm-hmm.
and stuff. So
mm-hmm.
There's a principle here that we haven't mentioned, that all energies in nature are in use already.
Uh-huh.
And when somebody says, oh, there's some energy, there's some tidal energy, or there's some wave energy, or sun, we'll tap this unused source of energy. It's in
good
use
point.
Already, and that you're getting the economic good out of it, because
right.
it's cleaning up your water and giving your life support, protecting your coastline and giving you fisheries and all these things. And you forgot about those.
Right.
Of course, it's like the salmon. You take the water for the hydroelectric power, you won't have it for salmon. So you can't have it both ways.
It reminds me of the politicians in South Florida who would eye the Suwannee River and say, that water's not being used.
Gosh. Well, you're at Cedar Keys, of course. And,
yes.
And, of course, water's coming out, turned coastally, you know, in the northern hemisphere, because of the Carless Force, they tend to swing to the right,
mm-hmm.
so that means they tend to swing north,
mm-hmm.
and so that coasts from the Suwannee River north, but sometimes it comes south to Cedar Keys. But keeping that fresh water enriches, but there are several different patterns. If you do it with pulses, as in a big river, then you get low diversity but high productivity. So you get oyster reefs and an oyster industry, for example.
Yes.
If it comes out slowly and gradually, as in springs or something, then you'll get a high diversity. Maybe you'll get grass flats with
mm-hmm.
with many kinds of things and
mm-hmm.
not so much of any one. Now, both of those are valuable. One's more stable, one's a yield system. So
which is more valuable?
You have to evaluate it and see
mm-hmm.
The energy, but in those two cases, they're both going to have high values. But
mm-hmm.
that's where nature has put together different combinations to use the special circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when you first knock that out, you've knocked out a huge value.
Mm-hmm.
Then after a while, there'll be something else there that builds back some value.
Mm-hmm. How would you analyze something like that if you consider the huge human population in South Florida, looking at the Suwannee River, and weigh that against?
Yeah. Well, of course, that's it's the same thing. U.S. cut off the water to go into Mexico, you know, and the California
yes.
got hold of the Colorado River, a
right.
lot of it, and Arizona and so on. And the water is another principle I haven't mentioned. And is energies of one level, one quality, to get the full out of them, they need to interact with an energy of a lower quality or
mm-hmm.
a higher quality. That is, they have to amplify.
Mm-hmm.
And so water is a mean to attract fossil fuel investment. And,
mm-hmm.
and that ratio in Florida now is about 7-1. And so that for every unit of real wealth from nature, on the average, it can attract 7 times as much energy.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it becomes, for example, fisheries. It develops
mm-hmm.
the fishery industry.
Right.
You know, it becomes
right.
Cedar Key is becoming a tourist center. So
right.
it's a tourist industry. So if you knock out that fresh water, you not only knock out that energy, but you knock
right.
out what it could have attracted.
Yes.
So if you move it to South Florida, then you're going to lose 8 times the
mm-hmm.
amount you pull down. And then if you pull it down there where you've got it's too crowded,
mm-hmm.
then you're, there's an optimum density for maximum mm-hmm. empower production. So mm-hmm. you'll get less total production by mm-hmm. doing that. In other words, by keeping your water distributed, and that's what nature does,
yes.
keeping them spread out, then you get more, even counting what you can buy and bring in, you'll uh-huh. get more development. If you're in development, you'll mm-hmm. get more economic development by developing both areas than you will by trying to let one area that's mm-hmm. already fully developed to overdevelop.
Okay. Even accounting for the 15 million people they expect to live there, that would still hold true.
You would have, no, those people would live up, will be further north, and those people will have a better chance to survive when the fossil fuels mm-hmm. collapse.
I see.
That when, you know.
Yes. Have we talked about Florida Bay yet?
No.
Okay, let's talk.
Florida Bay is naturally like the bays of Texas that I used to work in. That mm-hmm. is, it's a little bit hypersaline. That is, you know, seawater is 3.5%, 35 parts per thousand, and it's higher. Mm-hmm. And that, when the salinity is high, as we've already said, that tends to channel the productivity into a few things. And so they traditionally had a lot of pink shrimp, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So then you cut off the Everglades, of course, and you've
right.
And you had some variation there where it was high salinity and then low salinity, depending. And but all that keeps changing. And but then the worst thing is that the turbidity of dredgings.
Mm-hmm.
And once that's happened, this takes a long time for it to get pinned down by plants and microbes and. And so every time the wind blows, it stirs up, or the boat stirred up, and
mm-hmm.
so then that cuts out the light, cuts out the productivity. So in around the Keys, even within a foot or two of the surface, in magnificent grass flats and other things, whatever the shallow mm-hmm. is, when it's shallow enough, as soon as you get deeper than that, it don't get it because it's shaded, light shaded out. So,
mm-hmm.
so it's that turbidity problem and getting it pinned down. Is,
and what will be the impact of that ultimately?
Well,
it,
right
Bay?
Now you have less productivity and less wealth, but it can be, management can do some things about that. Partly is too much power in mm-hmm. and boats and
mm-hmm.
Getting the Everglades water flowing back through there will probably help the Thousand Islands.
How about the issue of the freeze line moving south and the transfer of citrus south?
Well, as you know, orange industry of Florida used to be more central Florida, you know, like between here and Orlando, and then very severe freezes knocked most of the trees out, and so the growers all moved south and drained wetlands and did them there instead.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we've ever calculated it, but I think that freeze line has moved south because of the draining of wetlands.
Mm-hmm. It causes, okay.
It's been proven that if you've got a freeze, a night of freezes, the way you keep oranges protected, all the smoke and all the turbulence in the world is not as good as just simply wetting them.
Yes.
Because the heat of vaporization of water.
Yes.
It won't freeze as long as there's any water there.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have wetlands extensive all through the small wetlands and the big ones and so mm-hmm. on, I think they've late at night, the air on the ground, it was kept from above freezing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure of that. That mm-hmm. hadn't been calculated out, but that's mm-hmm. one of our suspicions.
Mm-hmm. And so how far south might it be lost?
Well, you know where the orange industry is now.
Yeah.
It's Orlando South.
Yeah. How about the Fen Holloway River? Did you work on...
Well, it's an interesting thing. I was here as a young faculty member in biology and teaching limnology, and so there was a proposal to classify the rivers of Florida, not according to what's in them or not according to the ecology in those days, but according to the uses we wish to make of them.
Mm.
And so they made up an industrial river classification and then something else, and you know, like one for freshwater drinking and one for industrial waste.
Oh, hold on just
all
a
right.
moment.
Sorry.
Oh, no, no, go ahead. I thought it stopped, but it hadn't. So this was when you were first up Florida
yes,
in
that's
the 50s.
Right. And so here's a young guy right
wow.
out of school, and they took me up to one of the legislative committees in Tallahassee.
Wow.
And I tried to explain all this to them, and it didn't have any effect. And of course, biologists against it, but they went ahead anyway and made it Industrial River.
Huh.
So then they set up the paper mills that are at Perry and so on, and
right.
just pumped the stuff out. And so this was with everything, the toxins and the acids and the, and of course the main thing in paper is the black water, and that's the 1/3 of a tree is lignin.
Mm-hmm.
And when a tree decomposes that lignin, which is natural, normal, that becomes the peat or the peaty colloidal waters, and they are healthy, and they are the best absorbers of toxins and heavy metals and that there is, and that's part of this Gaia idea, that the wetlands have developed their characteristics and the trees to match it have developed the lignin, so that the whole thing will purify the fresh waters of the earth. And so here we are considering peat to burn it up, or mm-hmm. in paper mills we take out the fibers, and here's 1/3 of the weight that goes into this black water, and we dump it somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And well, all that stuff, poisonous, and the lignin. Lignin itself is not, but it, in huge concentrations and with the wrong molecular size, it can use up the oxygen too fast and knock it. So this goes down the Finn Holloway River, and so you get, as been beautifully documented by some of the Tallahassee Livingston people, you get this whole big area off the mouth, which is essentially knocked out. It's got, instead of the grass flats that you are used to, it, see the keys there above and below this, and then in this zone.
Mm-hmm.
So a whole section of tourism and fishing and value has been knocked out by this.
Yes.
And we've had a thesis done to help bring out a better idea, which is that lignin, it ought to go back where it belongs, which is into the pineland wetlands, and
mm-hmm.
there it mixes with the ordinary lignin and becomes part of the gradual purification. That is, having some black water in the streams is fine. That's
mm-hmm.
that's what Suwannee River is. That's
right.
what all the rivers are.
Hmm.
But, and of course, so EPA finally decided they weren't going to let them do that. So this is about 3 or 4 years ago. And so the latest controversy then was that they proposed to, instead of turning loose into that river, they'd run a pipeline
into the Gulf
and get it there quicker.
Yeah.
And with less treatment.
Yeah.
And so then Steve Medina, who's a lawyer, got some of us involved. And we had two plans, Mark Brown's plan and one I was pushing. And both, and one was to pump it uphill. It's only 10 feet uphill, back into the pine lands and
mm-hmm.
into the little swamps that are between the pines.
Mm.
And we calculated all the energies involved and what it would take and all the energy. The other one was to build a strand, that is a strip of wetlands, and run it from there, from Perry on down into the coastal wetlands,
mm-hmm.
right on into the marshes. And so by the time it went through there, you would have all the stuff
yes.
worked back into being, that is, this lignin would be mixed with the natural lignin and would gradually be an ordinary black water, and you'd filter out any other toxins. And so both those plans turn out to give you a multi-million dollar benefit
mm-hmm.
and, in them dollars compared to the other two, which is one, leave it the way it is, and two,
mm-hmm.
put that pipe in there. So,
mm-hmm.
so that's an example of...
So what was the response to those plans?
Well, they had us come in and testify, and we, you know, these hearings that they have.
Uh-huh.
And so I testified a couple of hours and all this, and I guess they had trouble with me because... part of my emphasis was the thing you want to do is protect the jobs at Perry.
Yes.
And if you don't protect this, the pressure of tourist interests and retirees
yes.
is going to build up, and it's going to tell you you can't even have a paper mill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to knock out your whole system. So
mm-hmm.
that doesn't make any sense. And so you want, and the shortage up there is water, and
mm-hmm.
these paper mills use so much water. If you put it back in the pine lands, it percolates back down and recharges the water, which
yes.
is... So, It just made all kind of sense. The only problems is you have to get hold of the lands or get easements or something so you can do it, because the lands
mm-hmm.
have been owned by several landowners. So the after that, the EPA took it under advisement, and I guess the whole thing's still pending.
Hmm.
But that's one of our current controversies, and
mm-hmm.
it's not just there. I went over to St. John's Water Management District and sought an opportunity and gave a lecture over there as well, and they asked and brought in the Palatka
yes.
people, and,
mm-hmm.
and I think they, in the study we had made by one Keller's thesis that he did, For a while, they had run some of their waste into their wetland over there, which was a floodplain wetland. So we went over, but then EPA forced them to quit, to dump it into the river instead, which is stupid. I mean, EPA and state and otherwise keep being populated with people who are conservation-minded. Instead of asking what makes the best system, they go to these extremes, and then they end up with a political decision. So we went and looked, and the tree growth had increased during that period, and the diversity had been maintained during that period, and just, in other words, it was a good solution they had before, and they needed to go back to it, which is to, again, run the paper waste, get the actual toxins out. They can do that. That's industrially, and they're being forced to do that now.
Right.
And then, but the rest of it, run it through the wetlands. So, anyway, so I think we're making progress. But that's been our role, is to see what the correct answer is, what the good ecological engineering, and particularly when it sounds so new and different and costly, people is just pound away at it and get some numbers and some data and then use the energy to prove it.
Yes.
And they can't knock it down, but you still have one today because they still got to wait till the pressure for it builds up in the clientele to get the political action. And that's where the journalists, if they would just take some time and learn energy and learn a little bit about it and insist that energy evaluation be made of everything, they could cause environment to improve greatly.
How did Buckeye Cellulose respond to that proposal on the Fen Holloway that you guys had? Do you remember?
Sure. And we're going to write all this up one of these days. I was going to wait till there was some kind of solution and then write it up. Well, at first, they're trying to defend their initial position. And of course, industry often thinks short range. What do I have to do this year or the next 3 years? And they keep buying and selling that plant. I don't even know who owns it right now. That was Procter & Gamble for a while and so on. So you'd have to follow up with Steve Medina, and I haven't heard from him in a long time. He was giving his services more or less to, and there was a group of citizens from that area who were pushing it, and we got involved and brought in this more general issue.
Mm-hmm. How have citizen activists generally responded to your energy analysis?
If we get a chance to explain it, I think they like it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it goes against something that's really deeply ingrained. Example, Margie Carr, after Archie's death, and she was being a leader, I studied Silver Springs a lot, and when the Rodman Dam cut off the mullet and cut off the shad and cut off the big catfish, and so all of a sudden Silver Springs had nothing to show their people. This was 10. I had another thesis done on it by Bob Knight, who's now with a port environmental consultant and a wetlands restorer, and as Mark was saying, our students are the